Hi everyone, Ian Gardner here with another fortnightly news episode. Where are we? It's Monday the 9th of August. It's early afternoon. Just finished the recording. We had a fabulous show with some great panelists. Look, the biggest news of the fortnight really was the Afterpay acquisition by Square. $40 billion transaction. Amazing outcome for the founders, for the investors, for the employees, for the ecosystem. And we're going to get quite deep into that. Assembled a great panel to help talk about it. Danny Gilligan is here from Reinventure. He was one of the founding partners there along with Simon Kant. So he's obviously got some expertise in this. Tessa Court is with us. She is the CEO and founder at Intelligence Bank, which is a Melbourne-based company. Also in the news, and we talk about this, she just raised a $50 million investment round from Five Elms Capital. I'm delighted to be joined by Kevin Joshelton, who comes to us from Sydney. He is on sabbatical. He's done a few things during his year off, but one of them is the Tech Report, which is a daily update and the tech news that we should all be reading. So do check that out. And Kevin had some great insights. And yeah, it was amazing to have in the show. Let's jump over to the panel and hear what was going on in the news. Here we go. All right. Welcome, everyone. This is our weekly, but it's fortnightly news podcast. Once again, we are joined with a terrific panel. We're back to the format of three rather than two. So we always try and get an investor, a founder and an ecosystem leader. So maybe I'll just take them in that order. So first up, representing the investor world is Danny Gilligan. Danny is a partner, one of the founding partners at Reinventure, which is a Westpac-backed venture fund. Danny, what's been happening with you?
We've had kind of a busy year working through some material exits across our portfolio. You know, our first fund's kind of hitting 7-year maturity, and that's about the time that a lot of activity starts happening. And I actually also just completed my first...
Just on that, I mean, we had Simon on and he was talking about the Coinbase exit. So, I mean, that was massive. And you were kind of the partner behind that, rather than Simon, so you should be taking the credit here.
No, not at all. No. Actually, I think it'd be remiss of me not to acknowledge that Simon did a lot of the heavy lifting getting that deal through Westpac. It was an extremely difficult deal to convince them to do. And so he did a lot of great work. But no, we both contributed the right push at the right point and got very lucky with that. I've also just completed my first new investment in 2 years, so I'm excited to be back writing term sheets, so that's good.
All right. Well, welcome back and welcome to the show. It's good to see you. We're all still remote. We have never done a face-to-face news podcast, so I am very much looking forward to the day that we can do that. Hopefully, we'll get there. So next up on the phone, representing founders, Tessa Court, all the way from Melbourne. Tessa is the CEO and founder at Intelligence Bank. I've known you for quite a few years now, Tessa. I came across you when I was at AWS. Fantastic business. You're actually in the news this week as well. So, maybe you can allude to that and just give us a bit of background to you and Intelligence Bank.
Yeah, sure. So Intelligence Bank is a marketing operations platform. So we are a system of record for marketing teams. So we help them manage their digital assets and creative approvals and workflows and things like that. We recently secured a majority investment from Five Elms Capital in the US, who invested 50 million Aussie into Intelligence Bank, which has been a great outcome for us. So we've been talking to Five Elms for a couple of years now and secured the deal just on June 30th. So, you know, everything happens in one day, end of financial year and closing, you know, a very big deal. So it was a great outcome for us. And, you know, we're off and running and in the middle of two lockdowns. So it's been a crazy time, but, you know, all really good and really positive. And we're super excited about our new partnership with our new investors. So it's been really good.
Congrats on that. I mean, that's a major deal from what sounds like a fantastic US investor. And we should ask you about your accent. So it doesn't sound like you're from these parts.
No, so I'm American, but I've lived in Australia since 1999. So before Intelligence Bank, I worked at Hitwise, which was an internet startup. So I was there from 99 till about 2007 when we exited to Experian.
Yeah, wow. There's a lot of the Hitwise mafia out there.
Yeah, still doing sure some amazing is. Things yep. in the sector. Sure is. Yep.
Yeah, there's been a few in the show. I can't remember all of them, but there's definitely got some Hipwise fingerprints all over the sector. So that's terrific. Yeah. And Tessa, you're also a member of Summit, which is our group for late stage founders. So hope you're enjoying that. All right, Kev. So I'm delighted that Kev is Kev Jockelson. Is that right? Yeah, yeah. It was because Jock. I'm pronouncing it like Loch. Most people can't pronounce Loch in Scottish, but I'm going Jock. So, Kev, like you've got an interesting background. I mean, you came kind of from the corporate world, and I think you're now on what you're calling a sabbatical or a self-learning sabbatical, which I love. Part of the reason that I really was keen to have you on the show is because you launched the Tech Report, which is a daily update that if you're listening to this, you really should sign up to. So TechRoport, and it's a daily wrap of the day's news. And I think the genesis of it rather flatteringly came from something you heard me say on a podcast. So yeah, Kev, give us a bit more context to that and how you're here.
Yeah, sure. So I was previously in banking. I started my own company called Fiestify, which was a startup doing major events anywhere around the world. I then joined Workyard, which is a Blackbird-backed company, and I was head of operations there for 5 years. And I was trying to come up with my next business and go back to being a founder. Nothing came my way, so I was inspired to kind of take a year off and build a business and launch one every 2 months until I found my next big thing. I wanted to kind of get the news and see what's happening with fundraising, which was the next big trend, and generally just kind of industry news as well. So I built the Tech Report to scratch my own itch. We used to have one that, you know, Ian mentioned on the podcast before, and that just disappeared. So I thought it was a good opportunity to start with that. And since then, I've launched another company called Kidcasso, which is an interior design e-commerce platform. And I actually just launched a liquor company called Noble Sage Liquor last week. So we do barrel-aged cocktails. We just launched the barrel-aged Negroni called the Noble Negroni. And now I have to kind of come up with my next one, but I'm really enjoying Noble Sage. And I read the Tech Report every day to find out what are trends and what I should be paying attention to.
Yeah, wow. Like you're definitely playing into the lockdown crowd with some pre-mixed cocktails there.
Yeah, for sure. So it's been kind of good timing with that, to be honest. So, people can't get to bars, which is sad, but at least we can deliver them a pretty awesome cocktail. People have been happy with, this is the bottle they obviously can't see in the pod, but people have enjoyed that. And, you know, we're getting feedback on that and work out how we can launch our next cocktails as well.
Oh, fantastic. And how much work does the Tech Report take?
Very little.
I sometimes wonder how much is automated and how much is, you know, you typing it all in.
No, incredibly. It's incredibly automated. I feel guilty how automated it is. I specialize in operations for startups. So I built it with this kind of, when I think about businesses, I think about my goals and anti-goals. And an anti-goal for me was I didn't want to spend every night like pulling together reports, TechCrunch, Product Hunt, and curate it. And so it just runs itself effectively. And occasionally I get abuse from people for including, a not so great article. And I have to explain that, like, you can blame the algorithm. But I just tweak it every so often. And, you know, we're now looking for sponsors and we're trying to grow it because we want more people reading the news and hearing about our ecosystem. So I'm trying to get people in the States and Asia reading the Tech Report as well.
I mean, look, it really is awesome. So everyone do check it out. And it comes out 7 days a week, hits the inbox about 7:24, I think it is, in the morning. So always looking out for that. Just went at my desk. All right, look, let's talk about the fortnight's news. It was pretty hard to escape the Afterpay acquisition by Square. I think the AFR had 38 separate articles that mentioned it over the fortnight. So pretty astonishing. And it was part of the reason I wanted to assemble this panel, especially Danny. I mean, Danny, you have got the background in the banking and finance world and, you know, the experience with Westpac as your LP and, you know, with a focus at Reinvention really around fintech and data as well. I mean, yeah, why don't we start with you and just give us your overall impression as to the Afterpay Square deal?
Well, I mean, there's a lot to cover there. I think one of the remarkable things, timing-related things around the reason the AFR 38 articles is James Ayers and Jonathan Shapiro just published a well-researched book around the Afterpay story right on the same day or or days prior to that acquisition being announced. And I know talking to James at the founders of Afterpay, were a little reluctant about participating in the studies around their book. And I think part of it obviously was due to the fact that, you know, these conversations must have been happening in the background, and they thought the story was perhaps a little premature. It's all landed with a remarkable kind of concurrence of activity. It's a phenomenal story, zero to 29 billion US in the space of 5-6 years is incredible. Just an incredible ride. They've done not just an amazing job in building out an entirely new category incredibly aggressively against some well-funded competitors, using largely public markets in Australia as a funding mechanism. But they've done a lot, I think, to develop a lot of talent and other opportunities in the ecosystem. I certainly know that a number of our portfolio companies in Reinventure have either received investment from or have secured material commercial deals with Afterpay. So they've become like a catalyst for secondary activity in the sector as well. And that's going to be really interesting to see how that continues to develop over time. But perhaps one of the most fascinating stories, which I think journalists have been picking up on, particularly more recently for me, is giving a more in-depth understanding of just how material an impact Afterpay is having on the financial services sector by watching the battle emerge between Afterpay and CBA. So the realization is dawning on banks that actually the core proposition that they really have is engagement. And the reason that they survived two transitions from, you know, analog to web and web to mobile is their engagement kept increasing through that phase. And Afterpay has come in with a primary engagement strategy for a youth audience that's absolutely dominating. And the only bank that's really responded to that in a material way is CBA. And they've responded pretty aggressively and are showing some real unique innovations globally for a bank, largely spurred on by the activities and strategies and plans of Afterpay. So I think they're not...
What are those strategies? Like, what is CBA doing?
Well, there's a number of things that they've been doing on both the consumer and the merchant front. On the consumer side, they're basically building out a ton of data-driven analytics, engagement strategies, additional adjacent propositions to make the CBA app more of a, almost like a personal financial advisor to their customers. So helping you determine what's the best broadband plan for you, the best energy plan for you, some insights around perhaps your shopping behaviors and insights that become suggestive. So pulling in more and more data into the CBA app experience and then using that to create an engagement strategy, which offers a lot more than just being responsive to banking strategies. And on the merchant side, they're looking at how they build a richer proposition for merchants. In fact, they acquired one of our portfolio companies called Doshi, which is a data engagement layer that sits between apps in the hospitality space and point of sale devices and payment services, so that they can offer merchants a richer set of engagements and a reason to choose MBA as a merchant platform, which is really what brings Afterpay and Square into a whole new, I think what AFR calls sixth pillar of banking now, because Square is incredibly capable on the merchant side of the business, has been less prevalent in Australia on the consumer side. So marrying Afterpay's incredible consumer engagement strategy and the huge customer base they have there with their retail shopping specific merchant engagement strategy on top of Square's payment rails and merchant acquiring infrastructure creates a pretty phenomenal out of left field new technology centric competitor in the banking industry.
That's fantastic insight. You also mentioned, or you didn't mention, that CBA did a massive deal with Klarna, which is a competitor.
Well, actually, that's one of the more fascinating things that I've seen, because they did a big deal with Klarna, learned obviously a lot about integrating that and engagement with customers, and then launched their own proposition,
because that's hundreds of millions they put into that.
It's one of those, you know, kind of questionable corporate investing strategy sometimes, and one of the risks you have as a startup working with a large corporate is, are they going to be a good partner or not? But they certainly invested a lot of capital and worked incredibly quickly to integrate Klarna, but then decided to go direct. I think that just shows how important that they think this is.
Yeah. Tessa, can I ask you sort of a more macro question just about the whole buy now, pay later? You know, is it just unregulated lending and, you know, is it here to stay?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, I think that, I mean, it's another form of credit at the end of the day. And so, you know, a lot of the buy now, pay later companies, I think there's 8 in Australia now, they've kind of self-regulated and they have this industry body. And I'm surprised there aren't more horror stories right now around, I guess, debt and, you know, problems that have come up from it. But I guess the amounts that, you know, that they're allowed to, I guess, borrow or, transact upon are relatively low. I think it's under $1,500. So, I guess the propensity for debt is relatively low and the defaults are relatively low compared to credit cards. And because there isn't, I guess, the interest per se, you don't have, I guess, the potential problems that you would have for credit cards. But I do see, you know, obviously what we saw from a Royal Commission perspective, you do see that freight train coming a mile away that will happen. So I do think it will get regulated over time. And I just don't think that, you know, government has caught up with it yet. But it will happen because at the end of the day, it is another form of credit that is occurring in the market. I guess what I would say also, but from a founder perspective, it is absolutely impressive, you know, in such a short period of time that, you know, they've been able to generate, you know, $5 billion of value per year in such a short period of time. It is, you know, an absolute incredible story that they have been able to do. And, you know, they've been able to do it because the credit card industry and the industry that they're playing in, especially in banking as well, is ripe for disruption. I mean, there's absolute room for innovation and it's a pretty exciting space. And I think there'll be more innovation too. And it's going to be pretty cool to watch.
Yeah, and look, you know, in terms of impact in the ecosystem, I mean, we touched on the Hipwise mafia. I mean, there's other mafias emerging. You've got the Canva mafia and the Atlassian mafia, and it's not mafia. I mean, that's the wrong expression, but you know, people with experience and cash that are coming from these companies. I mean, Nick Molnar, I think when he started the company, he was 24. I mean, I think he's only around 30, 31 right now, and you know, he's already built a company that's worth $40 billion. You know, so if you think about that trajectory compared to, you know, even Mike and Scott, I mean, that is ahead of them. You know, and maybe it's up around where the Canva folk are at, but I mean, oh my God, I think it's so good for the ecosystem. And apart from anything else, it's kind of this halo effect. People look at that and say, wow, they did that as youngsters in the space of a few years. Why can't I do that? Kev, is that part of the reason that you're doing your sabbatical? Are you going to invent the next Afterpay? And are we talking to the
I think this has like multiple impacts on the current ecosystem. First thing, I think that when you combine Afterpay with Canva, with Atlassian, you've kind of got our fang. So you've got like our ACCA, let's call it that. And I think if you're going to work for any company straight out of university, you're going to want to work for one of these guys. You know, some of these, hopefully some of the employees that come out of these companies will exit, start their next company as well and invest back into the ecosystem. I think a huge part of this deal was that there was rumors that that Molnar and Eisen were going to take Afterpay and list on the US stock exchange. And I know a lot of friends were contacting me or family and saying, hey, I've got Afterpay shares. How does that impact me? And this has been the most perfect kind of exit where they can actually exit, list on the US stock exchange and have a dual listing with Square here, which allows a lot of Aussie retailers to invest in Square locally. So enlist in a really big tech stock as well that's dual listed. And I think that's really exciting. And the fact that they're still, you know, appeasing Aussie investors who have backed them since they've been at a dollar is just great news as well, just for like, say, Aussie retail stock investors as well. So there's a lot to kind of unpack here and how it impacts the ecosystem, both for investors and for startups as well. In terms of me, I think there's no better time to start a company. I think it's just got easier and easier. I think there's more money than there's ever been. Hopefully with some of these exits, there'll be more angels. There's already more money in VC. So it's just super exciting and it's just a huge exit.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I mean, we haven't really touched much on, we've been talking about Afterpay, but I mean, Square is a you know, Goliath here as well. I mean, I think $40 billion at the time of purchase was 20, 25% of Square's overall value. You know, and let's maybe just reference Jack Dorsey. I mean, like, Jack is kind of the Elon Musk of the financial world. He seems to have two jobs. I mean, Elon's got more than two, but I mean, still having an astonishing impact on it, Twitter and Square. And I saw this article from Caro Waters, who's been on the show. She's a journalist at the SMH and The Age. She interviewed Jack Dorsey when he came out here in 2016. And at the time, Twitter and Square combined were worth $16 billion. Fast forward to now, that total is $180 billion. You know, so a pretty remarkable, you know, progress from there. I mean, Danny, like, how much do you know about Square and their ability to manage a deal like this and make it work?
Well, I don't know too much about Square directly, but I certainly have observed them as an interesting emerging competitor in the crypto domain relative to our investment in Coinbase. I think their most recent revenue announcement, something like 50 to 60% of Square's revenues are related to Bitcoin transactions. And I think
50 to 60%.
Yeah, I think what's
unbelievable,
remarkable about that is how rapidly founder-led fintechs of this size and scale are able to innovate on their core business models. That's what it really shows to me. We've seen that across other tech domains before. You've seen that with, you know, Facebook, Google, Amazon, etc. Founder-led companies and their ability to make really big non-consensus bets and have them pay off. So when I think about financial services as a category, we haven't really had one of those companies of that size and scale competing in financial services previously. So to have someone who has a vision about the domain like Jack Dorsey, someone like Nick and Anthony joining in that domain at the size and scale of that organization, it's incredibly dangerous to financial services companies around the world, I think, because founder-led companies that are able to make big calls on rapidly changing landscapes in the way that financial services is in both crypto and core fintech, I think is a pretty powerful combination. So I think that they're massively underrated. And the other organization I'd put in that category is Stripe as well. I think the Collison brothers are just next level. And because, again, they operate under the hood, not so consumer-centric, we don't see it as often. But I think between Square and Stripe and, to a lesser degree, PayPal, you're going to see a whole new wave of disruption hitting domestic financial services companies here over the next 5 years.
And any other, I mean, maybe just off the topic of Afterpay and Square for a sec, but who are your other standout fintech companies in Australia, startups in Australia?
Well, actually, I think the Afterpay deal is great for Zip, to be honest, because what's happening is there's pressure around consolidation in buy now, pay later globally. You know, teams are forming, so to speak. We've got investments in two buy now, pay later companies, one in Indonesia, one in India. And our Indonesian one just announced last week a SPAC on the NASDAQ, $2.5 billion US exit. We'll see if they make it to that point, because I think the consolidation pressure that's emerging in this industry is real. So I think that the Afterpay exit just shows that smart, strategic people with deep pockets think that this is a category worth making material bets on. And so, you know, I think that the team at Zip are another fantastic world-class team that don't quite get the same profile as Afterpay, but are such a good company.
Yeah. All right, look, we should probably move on to other topics. But before we do, like, Kev or Tessa, any last thoughts on this Afterpay Square deal that we haven't touched on already?
No, I think I would just say one other thing about, just on just the number of competitors and, you know, how, you know, I just think there's going to be just a flood more that are going to try, you know, there's going to be consolidation, but, you know, a race. You know, sometimes it's also a race to the bottom as well. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how many, you know, new entrants kind of come into the market too, you know, after this exit of Afterpay as well. And how many niche players try to come in as well.
Yeah. And Kev, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I have two comments. I think the first one was Square started paying attention to Australia last year, I think quite heavily. And that was actually because there was a failure, and that was Tyro. Tyro was down for 5 weeks last year, and people couldn't pay. And this is the FPOS machine. So this is like a huge blunder by like an Aussie company that, you know, super proud of. They've grown a massive company. They started effectively like a neobank. But everyone, if you can't get money for your company, you need to move on quickly. So they moved to Square. And all of a sudden, Square, it's a bit like Eventbrite. Like the guys from Eventbrite came over and they're like, why is everyone using Eventbrite in Australia? We didn't even like market here. It's, I think, because the tech scene embraced it. And the same thing happened here where Tyro, everyone was using them and they needed solutions. So they moved to the little white box called Square, and all of a sudden Square blew up, and then they've started paying attention to Australia. They probably paid attention to something called Afterpay. Afterpay's moved there, and it's kind of a little bit serendipitous, but I think it's come from that. So I think that's quite interesting. And the second thing is just like how awesome the Cash App is for Square. So the Cash App in America allows mostly young people to set up a bank account really quickly, transact really quickly, trade stocks, trade crypto, compared to the ACH process, which is like 5 days. You know, we're lucky in Australia where we can beam people instantly or pay people instantly. You don't have that in the US. So the Cash App is a game changer in the US, and it'll be interesting to see how they put Afterpay into that. And I think it's going to be an unbelievable product. And I'd be interested to see if they're still planning on rolling out the Money App that was kind of a copy of that here. And I don't know how that's going to play out in October. They say they're still doing it. But yeah, I'm not sure. But the Cash App is awesome, and it'll be interesting to see how Afterpay fits into that.
All right, let's put a pin in this one. I mean, but you know, if they're listening, Nick and Anthony, congrats. And all the early investors as well. I mean, there's plenty of Aussies that will be, richer and hopefully more experienced as a result of this. So yeah, just is a great deal all around. So like delighted to see it, and congrats to all involved in that Afterpay Square deal. All right, let's move on. Couple of things took our attention. So one, and again, it's great to have Danny here as a, you know, one of the inaugural members of the Stone and Chalk committee. You know, you helped sort of spearhead that. I think you were an official, you had a job in that committee that was beyond just a member of it, but you helped pull the Stone and Chalk together, which was kind of a template for what we're seeing at the new Salesforce Tower. So Salesforce Tower is just being finished at the moment. It's going to go up at, in Circular Quay, 56 stories. So it's a big tower, a lot of Salesforce employees. Three floors of that is going to be given over to a thing called the Greenhouse, which is going to be an innovation hub focused on tackling climate change. The contract's been awarded to Investable. Creel Price, who's one of the Investable partners, is going to be the CEO. Seems like a good deal. Like Danny, what do you know about this, and what can you tell us?
Well, I don't know much about it specifically. I mean, I know that Creel Price is a great guy, so they've certainly got someone fantastic in there to head that up. I mean, just sharing, you know, the reason we set up Stone and Chalk and kind of what came from it is, you know, at the beginning, 2014, when we kind of got going at Reinventure, the fintech community was small and quite scattered. And the idea was to create some density or something to kind of give it a bit more material substance in the city where it was difficult for startups to achieve economic rents, et cetera. And then to be a catalyst for more sustained activity in the sector. And from Stone and Chalk came Fintech Australia, which was, you know, an incredibly successful industry lobby group, which has driven all of the policy change. And quite quickly, the fintech community in Australia grew from not being on the map to number 5 or 6 globally out of Sydney. And it actually outgrew Stone and Chalk pretty quickly, actually. And so Stone and Chalk then became more of a co-working space. And that's all you really hope that these things do, is they become, they create density, which creates power, impetus, energy, a point of connection for industry, a point of connection for government, and becomes a catalyst for growth of a sector in a more material way. So I think if it does even half the job that Stone and Chalk did, it'll be a great success. And I think these things, they serve a purpose for a period of time. And if they do it well, then the community outgrows them quite quickly and then it has its own momentum.
Yeah. Well, and I think, look, it's I'm sure we're all of the same opinion on this panel here, but I mean, the world is at a tipping point, if not already gone over. I mean, climate change is not going away. We've basically buggered the planet, and it's not getting any better. So it feels to me like it's a bit of a duty of us as a ecosystem of leaders to do something about it. And personally, I think it's just an amazing thing to be focused on. Kev, any thoughts from you when you read this one?
My only thoughts is like, yeah, super positive seeing another space open up. Like it used to be Fishburne as an Ultimo when I was starting out, you know, and then you eventually moved to city, you know, thanks to people like Danny. But it does seem somewhat like every other week there's a new space opening up. It's nice to see like it's a dedicated space, but I'm a firm believer after kind of going through the ATP, the White Bay, that I'll see it when I believe it. Like I know it's probably going to happen, but you see a lot of these companies come out, announce something that sounds really great press. And then when you look back in 6 months and say, whatever happens to that space, it didn't eventuate. So sometimes it can be just press or it just falls apart. And like I know Barangaroo was going to have Lighthouse with Annie Parker. And I was excited to have, you know, Barangaroo, the sexiest new building in Sydney, having a space for startups. Like that didn't happen. And, you know, I like to walk into these places and see them before I believe that they kind of exist. But, you know, we need to do more for climate change, and having a dedicated space will be awesome when it eventuates. So, yeah.
and Tessa, I mean, you're in Melbourne. And is Melbourne, I'm trying to think of the, you know, the co-working spaces or spaces like this that are existing in Melbourne.
There's a lot, like Startup Victoria. I mean, and I've been involved with some of the ones for, you know, women in tech, and have done some mentoring there. I mean, I just think it's really important to pool resources. I think it's really hard to start a business. I think it's really hard to tackle a big global problem like climate change. So I think if the city of Sydney and Clovermore can throw in resources, if companies like Salesforce can do it, and you can get a bunch of smart people in a room together, even if they're just working in the same co-working space together, and they can share opportunities and share initiatives, I think it's great. And it's better than nothing. And sometimes they work and things happen and magic happens. And sometimes they don't and they fall over in a heap. But it's better than nothing, I think. And I think if you can create affordable spaces that bring people who are innovative together, it's a good start. That's what I would say. And that's what I think the Stone and Chalk folks do and have done in the past as well with their collaborative spaces.
Yeah. It seems like a good move, and I'm certainly a fan. There's another announcement in a similar vein around what they're calling a quantum terminal, which is, I don't know, is that a good name
or not?
It's a
great name.
But it's a quantum, I don't know. It's a quantum computing hub that they're going to be setting up around Tech Central, which is the central station end of the, you know, the other end of the city from Circular Quay. Danny, did you see this one? What did you make of this one?
Well, my only question in relation to this one is, being a quantum space, is it going to be open and closed at the same time? sorry, someone had to get in with the obligatory quantum joke. I think done well, these things create momentum, gravity, density, and are a catalytic agent in emerging spaces. And so I'd be excited to go hang out in a quantum space, to tell you the truth.
Seems pretty niche. I mean, Kev, do you think we're going to be seeing an emergence of all sorts of, you know, very niche focused hubs around the new tech precincts?
Yeah, I think so. I think that would be good. It's nice to have something like the startup space in Wynyard. Like for me, that one came out really quickly. Like I don't think there was as much hype as there could have been. And then all of a sudden it was there, which was awesome. So you could walk in and I could see it and believe it. What I do like about these spaces, like the Sydney Startup Hub and this one, is that they've got this kind of built on top of a station, which is very Asian. So like I lived in Hong Kong, spent time in Singapore, and I love being able to go to a train station and then there's like a space above. I like that about this. It does seem super niche. It seems quite focused to the universities like UTS and Sydney around them. So yeah, I'm interested to see. I can't say I have a deep understanding of kind of some of the quantum space or but, you know, I think the more we can do to pour fuel onto certain fires and try to be the leaders in certain industries, the better. Is this the industry that we're going to nail it? I'm not sure. Like, I think we're killing it in fintech and we should maybe focus a bit more there. But yeah, it's another great space.
It is. Look, it's an interesting sector. Yeah. I mean, wearing my Gelix hat, I mean, we made an investment in Quantum Brilliance late last year, which is a group out of Canberra, ANU, that's got a center of excellence, and they've invented a quantum computer that works at room temperature. Wow. You know, and I was an engineering science graduate. I thought I was quite smart, and I did a bit of a, tried to do a deep dive into some of the quantum realm. And, you know, after, and maybe I'm just, my attention span is like a goldfish now, but I kind of had a headache after an hour and just couldn't work it out. And it's super tough. I mean, this is a tough, tough industry. The opportunity is massive, but again, I just, the applications are, it's a bit like the early computing world. It's kind of, you couldn't really predict where it was going to go. You just know it's going to be huge. Tessa, any thoughts on this one or the quantum realm? Are you an expert?
Yeah, I mean, no, I'm not an expert on quantum computing, but I do think it's, you know, great to pull resources and provide a space for like-minded startups. I think only magic can happen from that. But yeah, no additional comment from me.
All right, well, let's jump to some other news. And Tessa, I might start with you. And we alluded to this at the top of the hour, but in the last fortnight, Intelligence Bank, which is your company, did land a $37 million US investment, which was announced in a few places.
Yeah.
Do you want to give any more context to that or why you wanted to do the deal and what it means for you?
Yeah, sure. So, it was a really, it was fun raising capital during COVID. No, I'm just kidding. So we had been growing pretty steadily, around 40% over the last 3 years. So, most of our business is in Australia. So we do about, 65% of our revenues here in Australia, but, we had raised some capital in, 2018, and had really started our US initiative there. So we had a small team in Irvine, California, about 10 people there. And we have also an office in Canada. So we had really built up some momentum in the US market. And, you know, we have about 200 customers, you know, enterprise customers there as well. So our overseas customer base is about 35% of our revenue and really, you know, started growing strong. And I guess we had to make the decision, you know, we could keep growing relatively organically. Or do we need a partner, especially from a US private equity group to really help, continue to grow? So we just did make that decision that it was time for us to get US funding. And it was less about the funding, but it was more about the partner who could also help us with strategic partnerships and, you know, really executing on the hiring plan and things like that, because it wasn't just the capital we needed, but it was assistance with, I guess, operational execution as well. So we had been talking to, I guess, Five Elms for a while, and we did undergo a process and spoke with several potential partners and ended up going with Five Elms, which we're, you know, really, really happy about. It's been about a month and a half, and building any business, you know, you're kind of climbing uphill, and you know, there are challenges with that, but it's like having wind behind your back when you have a, you know, really solid partner. So, so it's been really great. And we've got some exciting plans, not just to execute based on what we're doing, but really looking at new revenue streams and, new markets. And, we're really excited, about our next stage of growth. And so,
I mean, it's a chunk of change. Are you just going to use it to hire people, or is there anything else on the agenda?
Yeah, it's mostly, so we will be doing, mostly it's for, kind of hiring, and we'll be doubling down on our R&D team here in Melbourne. So we will be doubling our team here. But we will also
good luck hiring all those engineers. That's
Gonna
be a tricky one, isn't it?
Exactly. Especially remote. It's not easy, but we will be looking to do that. And then, you know, we do have a platform, and we have been successful incorporating third-party technologies into our platform. So we will be doing, you know, looking at M&A plays, you know, over time as well. So, and that's another reason why we wanted to expand and look for, I guess, a private equity partner who can help us with, you know, an M&A strategy moving forward too.
And just before we move on from you, Tess, I'd like, you touched on, you ran a process on this. So did you do that yourself or did you engage an external advisor?
No, we had an investment banker that helped us with that. We had a banker from Boston who helped us, look at, you know, players here, or I guess investors here as well as in the US. And we felt that it was important to, really cover all of our bases because we didn't want to, I guess, die not knowing. So we talked to everyone, and we ended up with a partner that we knew quite well, which, you know, I think at the end of the day, we probably would have done anyway, but it was important for us as a business to, you know, kind of canvas the market as well.
Yeah. And Danny, I'm not going to ask you necessarily about this deal. You can touch on it, and it's kind of not news related, but more of an operational question. But at what point should a startup think about using an advisor? Because at the seed stage, it's kind of a no-no. But at the stage Tessa was raising, I think it's sensible. So, but where in between is the right time to do it?
I think advisors can be useful in managing complex stakeholder processes. And kind of driving people to outcomes. Generally speaking, in the earlier stages, kind of seed A, even B, et cetera, there's an expectation for founders to kind of front their own engagement. So it's even okay to have a banker sometimes sit behind a founder. It's when a banker sits in front of a founder that I think it can create issues and slow processes down and change the perspective. But if founders have got incoming demand and it's not really a matter of can they raise money, but who are the parties they need to work through and what's the process, then it's useful extra arms and legs that may not be present inside the business at the time.
Yeah. Kev, any thoughts on this or should we touch about on some of the other deals?
I just want to say congratulations, Tessa, by the way. Raising any round is not easy, so well done.
Yeah, I just follow up with that. Like, congrats. It's great round. Exciting.
Yeah, thanks.
CultureAmp has, you know, doubled a unicorn. It's now at $2 billion valuation. I mean, I mean, the whole unicorn expression is a bit dumb, to be honest, but it's a metric and it's good to for the press to talk about. But they just raised $135 million, valuing them at $2 billion, which is a fantastic outcome. Tessa, it's a Melbourne company, Didier Ilzinger. I'm sure you've come across Didier before, but this seems like a good deal.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing, amazing achievement. And I think specifically, obviously the space that they're in is more and more important every day, given, you know, what we're all doing. And, you know, as teams are growing and building, the need to connect, you know, remote workforces and to manage the culture of an organization and people and workforces has never been more important. So, I mean, their valuation and their value proposition is, you know, well-founded and, congratulations to them. I mean, they've got a great company. I think they're a ways from profitability. So I'm, just kind of curious on how that's going for them and if that even matters. So Danny, I'd like to hear your opinion. Like if you're, you know, valued at $2 billion and you're still a ways from profitability, does that matter or not? I don't know. But I think they've got an amazing company and a great product. And I think the timing for them as a business is, you know, no better timing. So it's pretty impressive.
And look, it's another, we think about Blackbird. I mean, Blackbird was one of the early local backers of CultureAmp. And, you know, Blackbird's Fund One is just got some incredible businesses in there. I mean, everyone thinks of Canva, which is kind of the number one in there, but CultureAmp's in there, Safety Culture, Zooks, and a few others. Danny, did you read the list of investors here? I mean, TDM Growth Partners, I haven't come across them, but Sequoia, Salesforce Ventures.
TDM Growth Partners are a phenomenal growth fund. They're our General Atlantic of Australia, and Tom Cowan, who's one of the principals there, I think is one of the most sophisticated investors in the Australian market. So they're permanent capital there. If you don't know much about TDM and you're raising a Series B or Series C, they're one of the best domestic investors you could have on your balance sheet, to be honest. But
yeah,
look, a couple of quick comments. It's a very powerful raise. I think it took 6 to 7% dilution. to get that raise away, which means, you know, on the outside looking in, that's a power raise. I mean, Didier is a, whenever I've heard him speak, I've been blown away. I think he's a phenomenal leader. And, you know, I think Blackbird's Fund 1 is going to be the best VC fund now and for all time in Australian venture capital history.
Yeah. Even better than Reinventures Fund 1?
We hold the Fund 1 realized return limelight. We'll hold it for a very short period of time, a very narrow window. It'd be like Australia on the medals tally with the swimming events up early, and then we'll disappear down the line. But I'm so excited to see what Blackbird's Fund 1 does, because I think it's going to be incredible.
Yeah, no, it is amazing. I mean, who else was in here? So Blackbird, Skip Capital and Grok. So Mike and Scott are both in there too. Felicis, Index Ventures, Sapphire Ventures, Global Founders Capital. I mean, this is the who's who of what's out there. Kev, any thoughts on this? I mean, what wasn't announced on here, because it was actually quite a short article, was whether there was any secondary sales in here, you know, whether any early investors or staff were actually taking some cash off the table. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you'd hope so. Like, I don't think that's spoken enough about. And I think there's probably an opportunity for fintech company in Australia to offer some kind of like secondary market to some of these early stage employees to allow them to get cash off the table. Like, I still have a lot of friends or people that come to me and say, I want to join a startup. How does it work? And the idea that you can only take money at an exit. I think people like Canva have offered that to their employees, and that's been great. You know, some of them, they joke about, they took some money off the table and, you know, bought a couch where now they could kind of build, you know, buy like a resort instead. It's something they just have to weigh up. But yeah, it'd be great if they had taken money off the table. I'm not sure if they did, but you know, the company's a decade old and it says, you know, it's still not profitable, but the space is, the TAM of the space is growing exponentially as people work from home. Stuff like mental health is becoming a bigger priority for companies and checking with companies. So I think they're in the right space, and this valuation and the amount of investors in this just shows that they're, you know, they're really at the right space at the right time.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think you should ever regret too much about investment decisions.
Yeah.
I bought a laptop once with some Bitcoin back in 2015 that could have bought a McLaren Z1 or whatever it is. So anyway, that's there's a segue to the next the next item. Danny, I threw this one in because, you know, you obviously with your CoinJar experience have some crypto smarts. CoinJar, which is the, again, a Blackbird Fund 1 investment business. It's kind of an early cryptocurrency Bitcoin wallet, I think it was initially, but it does a bit more now. But they've launched a cryptocurrency MasterCard. So I'm a customer. I signed up, and literally on my Apple Pay now, I have the CoinJar card. I haven't actually tried it yet. I don't want to buy a cup of coffee and then regret that it was a Tesla again. So Danny, any thoughts on this one?
I think Ashutan and the team are great innovators in the crypto space in Australia. There aren't very many legitimate or useful on and off ramps to crypto world from the Australian market. And, you know, I think they're following a pretty solid path of innovation in the crypto space. There's a bunch of infrastructure going on underneath in the Bitcoin world, you know, the Lightning Network, et cetera, which are trying to take this from a more of a store of value into the payments domain. I think it's still early. And I think, you know, part of the challenge around turning that into a proper payments platform is exactly the one you outlined, Ian, which is in a high inflationary world, what's it going to cost me to buy this cup of coffee now? You know, it still, I think, falls more in the store of value investment kind of category than it does into the payments category for now.
Yeah, because I mean, one thing I've always struggled with Bitcoin in particular, but the rest are all true, is, you know, its ability to be a utility, you know, and the utility being an actual transaction mechanism rather than just a store of value. I remember trying to buy stuff with Bitcoin in the early days of it, and it was just really, really fiddly and difficult. You know, you had to, you know, get a QR code and do some other stuff with your wallet, and then it took a while, and it was a bad process. But if you can literally tap and go, that's kind of what we need, isn't it?
100%. And, you know, the simplest way we think about decentralized finance and the fintech world is fintech is the front end and DeFi is the back end. So, you know, the Ethereum's emerging to be the global settlements layer for the internet. And so as that back-end infrastructure becomes more and more useful, you'll see a lot more front-end fintech innovation like this from CoinJar on the front of that as well. And so, you know, this is going to be like a Microsoft Intel cycling of innovation between front-ends and back-ends, which will eventually propel us forward into something far more useful than what we have across the board in financial services today.
And Kev, as part of your sabbatical, have you been doing a deep dive into crypto or...?
I haven't just yet, but I'm incredibly excited about the space. Interestingly enough, I know that you shared this article about Loda being able to kind of lend money off the back of your crypto. And I don't think there's an Australian competitor really doing that right now. I know Danny can probably disagree with me, but I think it's off the back. Is that right? I don't know. But off the back of something like Compound, which kind of started that kind of protocol. And interestingly enough, I caught up with Dave Kuhn, who's in the space. He's kind of an old friend of mine, and he wrote the white paper for Compound, and like he didn't kind of really factor that in, that they've kind of blown up since then. So the ability to take cryptocurrency, store it, borrow money against it, I think is really interesting. And I really like this kind of business model. So I was explaining that you can have a mortgage-backed security, you can have a mortgage, which is like a security-backed loan where a bank kind of allows you to buy a house and you sit in that house. And if you fail, they'll come and rip the house from you. But you actually sit on that house. The difference here is that you actually have your crypto sitting in a marketplace. They lend you the money. And if you fail, they own your crypto. So it's actually a really smart business model for them where they're actually holding the asset. They don't have to come and evict you from your asset. They own it. So they've kind of reduced the risk there, which is really interesting. So I think there's like kind of a bit of a fintech renaissance with crypto and having some really smart engineering minds coming in and playing in the banking scene. I just think kind of the sky's the limit on what's going to happen. And I think we could have a much bigger space in crypto in Australia. And yeah, I am interested in the space. I'm not exploring it deeply right now, but I'm definitely paying attention to it.
Yeah. Tessa, what about you? Any thoughts on this? Are you a crypto
expert?
No,
I mean, no, I'm not a crypto expert. But I do just think it's really interesting and ironic how you do need a credit card to make it work and make it easy, you know? So it's like everything, you know, you want to have, obviously, you know, crypto is, you know, a non-physical monetary unit, but you need plastic to kind of transact in the real world. And I think that's, you know, super interesting. And making it easy will make it more useful. And yeah, I think that's the future of it, for it to be more, you know, more widely used. And people are obviously making a fortune out of it and trading it right now, but that will make it, yeah, ease of use is, I guess, the key for the future of it as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's a bunch of other, you know, good, but you know, relatively small transactions that I don't think we'll touch on here. Let's maybe just jump to the last story that we'll talk of. AirWallex, which is a Melbourne-based business, also got some tentacles into China, backed by SquarePeg and a few others. Very successful. They're launching a $270 million VC fund, which I certainly raised my eyebrows when I saw it. Danny, what did you think about this one?
Well, I mean, I only read it from the article that you sent through, Ian, so I don't know much more about it. The only thing, I guess, that surprised me about this was that it focused the narrative for investment on AirWallex ecosystem, but it didn't seem that AirWallex itself was an investor in the fund. Most corporates.
Is it just the co-founders or is it the corporate?
Yeah, it looks like the co-founders and then outside investors. And the only, you know, where I've seen this done, you know, we've had one venture. We had Coinbase, who created a venture fund early on, but they were the 100% LP. Even Afterpay Ventures, I think Afterpay is 50% LP in that. And so that drives a lot more alignment and a management of conflict of interest between the kind of the parent company and the portfolio companies. And so it wasn't clear to me how they'll manage the complexity of potential conflict in that scenario.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. Tessa, you're sort of smiling at this. Yeah. Any thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, I kind of I think there's kind of two different things. I mean, I know a lot of founders have investor aspirations, but I do think it's really hard to cross that chasm. I think if you're, you know, I know founders have, yeah, investor fantasies, like they think they can do it really easily, but it is a different beast. And I do agree with Danny about the conflict. And I think taking a strategic investment early is problematic because it doesn't give that company air to grow and no pun intended, I guess being air wallets, but I think it also can be problematic because it ends up just being a development arm. So if you want a development arm, just go, you know, fund something and, you know, make it a development arm of AirWallex, you know, don't make it, a separate investment. So I don't know. I think, you know, that the article was very limited in what it showed, but I do think very few founders get the investment thing right. I do think, you know, some of them do, but not always. And I do think there is inherent conflict. It does stifle the potential of businesses. And again, if AirWallex wants to incubate companies or ideas, it can do that in another way. It doesn't have to be a VC.
Yeah. Well, and I have to say, look, you know, wearing my Gelix hat again, I mean, I've been out all year raising our first fund, and it's come from just a bunch of high net worth individuals. And, you know, obviously I've tapped up a few of the, you know, the wealthy tech founders that we'd all know. I'm not going to name them, you know, and maybe it's just because they're being nice to me and just trying to find a polite way to say no. But the best ones are basically too busy with their day job to be that worried about making side investments. And this seems to be like this AirWallex deal seems to be just falling into that trap of, you know, having some money in your own personal balance sheet and thinking that you're going to make a good investment decisions whilst you're still trying to run the company on the side. And I think it is fraught with danger. Kev, any thoughts on this one from your side?
The only thing I can think about is if they are using kind of being a bank, they have all the information of their customers so they can invest in them. Which, yeah, has like a little bit of a conflict of interest, but then I think they should say this is a purely like AirWallex is the only LP in this fund and we're happy to back companies. But I think the better way to go about doing this is kind of what's happening in the US with companies like Pype, where Pype is a company that looks at SaaS companies and basically can predict its revenue and then fund them that's like non-dilutionary. And that would be a better way to go about kind of investing in the ecosystem, looking at the companies that are already banking with AirWallex. Like I bank with AirWallex. It's a great platform. It's awesome. I can scale globally really easily. And they could see that I'm growing exponentially and they can come to me and say, we'll lend you money or we'll invest in you. But yeah, I agree with all the other panelists that yeah. It can be a massive distraction wanting to be an investor as well. And I think that's unclear. So
yeah. Look, there's a lot here that's not clear. So if you're listening, AirWallex founders, then don't take it what we're saying as criticism and maybe get in touch and we'll get you on the show and you can tell us all about it. All right, look, let's leave it there. Thank you, Kev, Tessa, Danny. Appreciate you taking time out your busy schedules. And look, it was great to catch up with you all. It's always fun doing these. And thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll see you in the next one.